I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Euthanasia, podcasting, and the Dakota Access Pipeline. These topics are all up for discussion in Columbia this weekend at the Missouri High School Ethics Bowl. Today, we'll talk to two local coaches about how the competition and the civil debate it promotes help break down barriers between the teenagers who take part. Then we'll take a look at the potential winners and losers in Governor Eric Greitens' new budget proposal for Missouri. And we'll examine what the governor's plan says about the priorities for state government. Later, this week's edition of State House Blend. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The questions are thorny, the dilemmas are realistic. Some of the great moral questions are on the line when area high schoolers get together for the annual Missouri Ethics Bowl. High school students on both sides of the state line can compete this weekend. In each round of competition, teams take turns analyzing cases about complex ethical dilemmas. Here's one. Can a father ever lie to his family about finances when it might spare family members a lot of distress? And another one. What if you don't like your best friend's fiancé for reasons that include you don't think she's truthful? He asked you to be his best man. What's your obligation to tell your friend what you really think about the fiancé? That's a tough one, and it's one more reason why I prefer asking the questions around here to answering them. With us to talk about the High School Ethics Bowl are Ruth Ann Falls. She's an ethics coach at Olathe High School. Ruth Ann, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Drew Baranowski is here in the studio with me. He's coach at Shawnee Mission South High School. Drew, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Well, Drew, if high school students have to sort out this dilemma with the fiancé, the least I can do is ask you to sort this one through. Maybe by doing so, you can show us how some of this works. How would you begin to navigate it?
The most important thing for the students is to figure out what they think is right. And I think that's the big thing with the Ethics Bowl versus like traditional debate. And it's a tough one because there are issues that case studies that have very clear, I think, dividing lines along political and religious and a lot of belief-based values. But you get into a case like that, and it's very personal, and it definitely inspires some very spirited debate. In regards to that particular case study, I think you have to be just a good friend. And I'm not sure what that means all the time, but that's I think, even the spirit of what we're trying to accomplish, that's a valid answer to some extent.
Ruth Ann, spirited debate goes hand in hand with what you guys do, right?
Yes. It really is a joyous thing to observe in these times, to see young people engaging in true dialogue, in the spirit of dialogue. And ethical dialogue is a unique communication style, and unfortunately our students have not seen a lot of role-playing, positive
yes.
role-playing in politics and society and news media. So it is a very, very special type of dialogue, and it values all participants, and there is a measure of trust from the beginning. And it's just an awesome thing for them to participate in.
But Ruth Ann, it helps, doesn't it, that there is obviously, with so many of these, there's no right answer, right?
Absolutely not usually. There could be perhaps from a perspective a more correct, but the teams are not concerned with right versus wrong. They are concerned with leaving no problem unturned or unanswered, and they're very, very much concerned in looking at the situation from all stakeholders' perspectives.
That's interesting. You know, Drew, I can't help but notice these questions are really tough.
Yeah, they are, and I think that's been one of the enjoyable things for me, seeing my students, seeing high school students navigate questions that that give me a lot of pause, that I've shown them to my friends, my family members, just to get their opinions, because I'm new at this too. And they've all had the same general feedback, is that, just like you said, these are tough, and there is no right answer. So finding a way to truly justify and believe what you're and buy into what you're saying is really the what's at the center of what the students are trying to do.
You know, Drew, you were saying that your students came to you and said they had heard about this ethics bowl thing and they wanted to take part. It was a student-led initiative in a sense.
Yes. So I've been teaching pre-AP honors English for about 6 years now, and a lot of the material that we deal with in class in our written responses and the English side of things is dealing with real-world case studies and real-world applications. So a student of mine from last year came to me at the beginning of this year and told me that, you know, this was an option and that she thought that I would be a good fit for it and would I be interested? And I said, sure. I had no idea what I was getting into, and
here I am. How do you say no to that, right?
Yeah.
How many kids do you have taking part now?
So we'll have two teams, and we'll be bringing 9 students total to the Ethics Bowl, so 5 and 4 split. We've had about 15, but it's definitely been something that we've had a solid core of about 9 or 10 who really bought in and have weathered the entire process.
Ruth Ann, at Olathe South, how many kids do you have taking part?
Well, actually, I will only be bringing 4 members this year. My students are affiliated with an Olathe District Schools 21st Century Academy, and so all of their work is extracurricular, and because of time constraints, and the kids are having, you know, on internships and things, and just we have always fielded a small team. We also have a course, though, that during the last 12 years, the students that are members of the academy have been required to take, and that is a course really in ethical dialogue, and it's inquiry and it's case study. And sadly enough, the academy is in its last year, and so this is the last group that I will actually teach as a part of the curriculum.
How long has the High School Ethics Bowl in Missouri been around, Ruth Ann? What do you know about that?
5 years. And this year they're taking a big jump forward. I believe there was only 7 teams last year, so we're almost doubling the participants. So that's very exciting.
How do these things, Ruth Ann, differ from a high school debate tournament? Because these are two different animals, right?
Completely. In fact, it's interesting you should ask that question, because some of the most difficulty I've had in the past with my ethics class is when I have very proficient debaters come into the class and believe it's going to be a debate format. So we have to teach the tenets of ethical dialogue, and they fit right in after that.
If there's
Steve, it's not argumentation. It is never argumentation in ethical dialogue.
Drew, what else do you think kids get out of these competitions? I mean, Ruth Ann mentioned this notion that there hasn't been a lot of good role models on the national stage when it comes to how to disagree agreeably. What are you sensing from your kids and what they're picking up?
Kind of adding on to what Ruth Ann said, a lot of my students actually are debate students, but I do not have any debate background. So I think one of the reasons that they actually tapped me to sponsor and coach is that they wanted something fresh. They wanted like kind of an outside perspective. And so I think that's been something that I've seen them grow even from the beginning, is going from arguing to working together in terms of how they view the case studies, how they, being able to look at both sides of an issue and, you know, and argue, not argue, but acknowledge that there is an alternative viewpoint, and whether there's a kind of a clear line, you know, based along beliefs or a very ambiguous line, that being able to discuss, and again with a civil mindset, is something that is going to serve them well in, whether it's in academics or professionally or just in, you know, personally, to be able to sit down and chat.
You know, in a competition, is it just one person getting up at a time, or does the team all work together to sort of make the case?
There are various avenues, and really, I think within any of the rounds, as many members of the team can speak as needed.
Oh, there are there's no limit on that.
There are time limits, and there is a format of which teams speak at which times, but there's no active, like, interactive debate between the two teams. It is very much a one team goes and then the next team goes, but it can be one or many.
Yeah. Ruth Ann, I was wondering, you've been doing this for a few years. Have there been a few topics that absolutely buckled your knees in terms of how difficult they might be in trying to sort out the ethical dilemma that's at hand?
There are always those questions which rise to the top of difficulty. And this year is no different. Some of the most difficult cases that my students have struggled with this year, oh gosh, include psychological disorders such as bodily identity integrity disorder.
I saw one example where, wasn't there a case where a young woman wanted to be blind, and she was determined to be blind, and she took steps to make herself blind, and there's, I think you just referred to it, there's an actual disorder, which I had never heard of before, that that describes that. And the question on the table is, you know, should she be allowed to pursue her longstanding dream or not, right?
Her true self. And it's just so challenging in so many ways. Another case deals with urban gentrification. And that is such... an adult and urban planning, and you know, and here we have high school students who are researching and trying to find, you know, and uncover all the stakeholders involved so they can address both sides of the issue, and there is no clear right or wrong. It is just a joy, you know, really to work with the kids. And I have to echo with Drew, you know, this is challenging me and pushing me, and it's something that everybody should witness and have the ability to do, in my opinion. And if I might just add one more thing.
Yeah.
As our world and technology races ahead, there's going to be a need for students to solve problems. And this is the perfect format, the perfect practice for them to take society's most incredibly difficult dilemmas and be able to appreciate the fact that we do have a diverse culture now. It's becoming more diverse as we go, both religiously and philosophically. Ethical dialogue allows those conversations to take place between people.
Well, as you're speaking, Ruth Ann, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I'm wondering, you know, if area churches, area libraries, you can begin to see this thing snowball a little bit if other groups begin to take part.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as I transition from education, I have had a 40-year degree, and I'm transitioning from education. That's one of the things that I, you know, hope that I'm able to continue in some way. It's necessary. Kids grow from it. The communities will grow from it. It's nothing but positive. And I am so grateful to Columbia College for sponsoring this activity for our youth.
I was going to say Columbia College over in Columbia, Missouri, is sponsoring this weekend's Missouri High School Ethics Bowl that includes kids from other states, including Kansas as well. That's what we're talking about here this morning on Up to Date, this new idea of high school ethics bowls. Do kids, Drew, have a hard time hanging on to some of the concepts, at least at first? I mean, gentrification that Ruth Ann just mentioned, I mean, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's definitely it's forcing them to discuss and to become literate in things that are probably not part of a typical high school experience. Mm-hmm. Like you said, gentrification, some of the other topics, some of the international topics, and I think that's been one of the biggest things too for our students is, you know, we've seen it's interesting to see how they react to issues that are rooted in emotional responses versus, you know, there are ones on there about animal cruelty and, you know, things like that, that they have some roots in terms of their emotions. But for them to, you know, that's where community leaders come from. I think that's where people who get involved with topics and issues that surround them come from, this kind of stuff, is people who learn that there are things out there that are worth caring about and worth having these discussions about.
So how do you prepare them for the big state competition going on this weekend? What's your process?
As a new coach and sponsor, it's been a lot of YouTube video watching and Google searches and things like that.
Because you don't have tournaments between area high schools, do you?
That's another of the big differences between this and debate, is that it's one and done.
Oh, it's one state competition. That's it.
Yeah, you get the case studies back several months ago. They released them just in
September.
General.
September, I believe, was released this year.
Yeah. But again, Ruth Ann, it seems like a logical way to grow in the future is to begin having dual debates with other high schools, for instance.
Well, I certainly hope so. Through the Professional Careers Academy, we had two ethics conferences in the last 5 years, and we brought kids together, had keynote speakers, and we partnered with Kansas State University's leadership kiddos at that time. And so we know that gave me the perspective that the need is out there. And so if we could find a way to make a local model, it would bring only good to our community. So,
Drew, I'm wondering, do you get into the teachings of the great philosophers in the work that you do with the kids?
We have not done anything specific with the true philosophers, the classic philosophers. I know that's an actual interest of several of the students, and that was, I think, where part of this came from. The original student who contacted me used to sit in my English class and read philosophy books, which I didn't have much of a problem with.
Yeah,
but
right.
I think the fact that it's a transcendent skill and ability and topic, that it's something that is applicable from hundreds or thousands of years ago even, and it's still there, is, you know, just the human aspect of it is definitely something that not only do they have to learn, but as Ruth Ann said, it's critical going forward that you're still going to need humans to solve human problems.
Do you get into the great philosophers, Ruth Ann?
We look at several models and references, such as utilitarianism and consequentialism, but in the actual contest, it's not about, you know, throwing those terms and you know, quoting, you know, theory from the model. It truly is just to help us wrap our head around different perspectives. The Ethics Bowl is a conversation, and it's teenagers discussing, you know, and so we don't pull a lot of technical aspects from the models.
Again, the Missouri High School Ethics Bowl takes place this weekend at Columbia College over in Columbia, and good luck to Drew Baranowski and the Shawnee Mission South High School, the team going from that school. Ruth Ann Falls joined us as well today. She's the ethics coach at Olathe South High School, and good luck to both of you. Be curious to hear how it goes.
Thanks very much for having us on.
Thank you very much.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk state budget in Missouri and the tax plan that Governor Eric Greitens is trotting out today as he makes his way around the state, including a visit to Riverside. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Yesterday on the show, I sat down with NPR correspondent Wade Goodwin. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll learn about a local group that's working to give Kansas City's black artists some online posterity. We'll also get reactions to President Trump's State of the Union address. Speaking of which, KCUR is hosting a State of the Union watch party and panel discussion this evening at Tap Cade in the Crossroads. I'll be there, and we'd love to see you there as well. For more information, check out KCUR.org. WR's Facebook page. Well, Governor Eric Greitens continues to dig out from a scandal centering around an extramarital affair. But in recent days, other things of consequence have also happened, and that is the governor released his proposed state budget and on Monday a sweeping $800 million tax cut plan. The governor doesn't get the final say on either the budget or the tax cut. The General Assembly now gets to weigh in, but his proposal set the table, and the governor made some notable recommendations. Among them, a cut of nearly $70 million to higher education in the state. With us to talk about all this is Tracy Gleason. She's director of communications and public engagement for the Missouri Budget Project. That's a nonprofit that aims to provide independent research on complex state policy issues and how they impact all Missourians. And Tracy, so nice to have you. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Well, let's start with the tax cut package, because that's the most recent development here. You had a decidedly mixed reaction yesterday to this $800 million package the governor has trotted out. Walk us through that, your reaction to it.
Sure. Well, you know, I want to start out by saying there were some positive components of the package that we were excited to see.
Such as?
The earned income tax credit. I think he called it a workers' first credit. That's something that we have been working on for a while. It's based on the federal earned income tax credit.
I was gonna say, yeah.
And so it's direct money that rewards lower income workers.
It's a tax credit, money right in their pocket.
Right. The difference between what he proposed and the federal credit is is refundable. So it recognizes that lower wage earners, even if they don't end up owing income taxes at the end of the year, they've paid sales taxes, they paid property taxes, they paid a lot of other things along the way. So it's a refundable credit to recognize those payments. At the state level, what Governor Greitens recommended was a non-refundable credit, but it is still a great step for Missouri.
And what's the difference between a refundable credit and a non-refundable credit?
So a refundable credit means that when you file your taxes, you could actually receive a payment back, whereas the non-refundable credit says if you don't owe any more than the credit, you know, it just zeros out.
Oh, I see.
Right.
Okay.
You know, the nice thing about the EITC is it is directed, it's targeted tax relief that instead of giving tax dollars, tax giveaways to the very wealthy or corporations who are maybe going to put it in a bank account, these are workers who are struggling oftentimes to make ends meet. They spend it in their local communities. So, you get a bang for your buck, but that money goes right back in and creating jobs locally as well.
Did you like anything else about his proposal?
It does address a lot of loopholes and outdated policies in the Missouri state tax system. Currently,
and one of them is, what if you pay your taxes on time, if you're a business, you get a break of some kind.
Right.
Which strikes me, I don't get a break if I file my taxes on time.
Exactly. You know, some of it goes back to the days where, I can't remember the name for the old calculators, but where people were sitting and they were having to go through the definitions and manually calculate that all. And so there was an incentive for businesses to submit sales taxes, for instance, on time. That's all out of date now. It's unnecessary. It's a giveaway. Missouri is very generous in how we calculate it. So there are a lot of things that we can do to bring Missouri's tax structure into the current century.
Mm-hmm.
The timely filing discount, the way that we treat online sales and collecting sales taxes that are owed for those.
And Governor Greitens is talking about starting a process, if I understand correctly, Tracy, to begin collecting taxes on online purchases.
Correct. Right.
Yeah.
You know, right now, the onus is on the consumer. We are actually supposed to be keeping track of how much we spend online or through catalogs. And if we go over a certain threshold, we're supposed to submit those taxes ourselves.
I didn't know that.
I think about 20 people in the state
Wow.
knew that.
Okay.
and actually did it, which honestly is more than you would think.
Yeah.
But this just would collect those sales taxes in the same way that they're collected for any other merchant. And it levels the playing field for local establishments.
Yes. And that's a fairly interesting step for a Republican governor to make, because haven't Republicans traditionally been opposed to collecting sales tax from online purchases?
Well, actually, Senator Blunt is a sponsor at the federal level.
Huh.
And this is actually an issue, you know, not to get too much into the weeds about it, but it would need both state level action as well as federal in order to kind of smooth out all the wrinkles. If we just pass the state legislation, it's more of a voluntary system that we would opt into. But there are currently the Supreme Court is reviewing a case from the early 90s that would address all of this as well.
But brick and mortar establishments have been complaining about this for a long time, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure about the current year, actually, but I know it's been on the Kansas City Chamber's priority list previously. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that people recognize is a flaw in the system, and it's picking winners and losers, which is not a partisan issue. We don't want to do that with our tax structure.
Okay. What issues do you have with Governor Greitens' tax proposal here?
Well, you know, I think going, you know, into our budget discussion a little bit, our state economy is in good shape. Our unemployment is low. The economy is doing well. And it's looking at corporate taxes. And we're doing all of this in the face of having to cut the state budget another $240 million next year after already having cut it this year.
So your point is there isn't enough money in the budget as it is to begin even talking about more tax cuts.
Exactly. You know, our state is competitive on a tax front, but until we can meet the needs of our communities, you know, this is not really a question that we should be debating right now. There are responsible ways that we can change our tax code, looking back at that timely filing discount and online sales that we talked about. And there are ways that we can target our tax system more appropriately to up those. You know, over the past couple of decades, we've given a lot of tax giveaways to the wealthy and corporations. It's made our tax system very unbalanced for the average Missouri worker. And they are bearing the burden of providing the services that we all need. And so there are things that we can do to take a look at that structure, but we shouldn't just be cutting willy-nilly.
Tracy Gleason is my guest. She's Director of Communications for the Missouri Budget Project. That's a nonprofit that aims to provide independent research on complex budget matters pertaining to the state of Missouri. We're talking about Governor Greitens' tax cut proposal and his new budget. You know, you said this the other day in a statement that you released before the budget came out, Tracy. You guys wrote this: by nearly every measure, Missouri invests less in critical public services today than it did 3 decades ago. That's a big statement. It gets to what you just were saying a minute ago. But what's the significance of that?
Well, you know, I think it's really kind of astounding when you look at some of the graphs and the numbers related to this, because we hear a lot about, oh, we're spending more on X, Y, and Z than we did last year. But there's inflation. There's population growth. And so it's comparing apples and oranges to look at those numbers sometimes. When you look at state revenue as a percent of the economy, which is a more kind of reliable metric to say, you know, to take all those things into account. When you look at the average spending per pupil, for instance, on higher education, you look at a lot of these metrics, we're falling behind. So we're giving all these tax giveaways out, but I don't think we ever heard Missourians say, you know, we're spending too much on our college kids. We really need to cut that and make them take out more loans.
Well, the old saw about Missouri is that we rank 48th or 46th or 49th in every category of spending across the board.
Right. And so, you know, to talk about cutting further when we're already sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul, we spent a lot of the last legislative session talking about what do we fund in terms of seniors and people with disabilities? Which needs are we not going to fulfill? And I don't think that any Missourian wants to pay a couple dollars less a month in order to, you know, so that grandma doesn't have skilled nursing at home when she needs it.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, what I am hoping for, the governor's tax policy is that if it opens the door to a more comprehensive conversation about the needs of Missourians, you know, the governor says that Missourians will get a tax cut, but Missourians have other needs as well. And we need to make sure that we're meeting those comprehensively.
Is it fair to say that Missouri remains a low tax state? Is there any question about that?
You know, people can sometimes find figures
to suit their needs.
But yeah, when you look at things, you can pick and choose certain numbers. But when you look at the broad landscape, yes, we're a competitive tax state. You know, with all of the cuts that we've had before, if that was something that was going to attract businesses, people would be flooding into the state. It's more than that. It's our infrastructure. It's our higher education. Do we have a skilled workforce?
Yeah. The other question you wonder about is this idea of there's a tax cut that's already in place that's just now being implemented. It's largely a corporate tax cut. Tell us about that.
Sure. It started being phased in January. In total, we're looking at it costing the state about $700 million a year. I think, you know, it was initially modeled largely on the Kansas tax cuts. Folks have kind of backed away from that argument a little bit and now are talking about how different it is than Kansas because we saw how it played out. I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind in Missouri is when things go south, we can't correct it the way they did there. Their legislators came back in, saw what was happening, and fixed it. Here in Missouri, it has to go to a vote of the people. And that's when you get all the special interest spending and all of that in.
That's because of something called the Hancock Amendment, right?
Right.
That passed a long time ago.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when we go back and look at sort of how the tax cuts started, I think there was an overreaction. For a couple of years there in the early 90s, we started hitting up against this upper limit of what Missouri could collect from taxpayers. And in response, the pendulum swung too far and legislators said, oh, we're collecting, you know, we're having to send out these rebate checks under Hancock, which were like $40 a year for most taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
But in response to that, they cut massively and cut about $1 billion a year in an ongoing way. And we're seeing the effects of that now with our foster care reimbursement rates being low, our higher education spending being cut. K-12 education, it's being funded theoretically in the classroom, but we've cut transportation.
Yeah.
So if you don't get kids to school, we're seeing the effects of it in every realm.
You know, already you get a sense that there's a lot of skepticism, even from the governor's own party, about the tax cut package. Tracy, what are you picking up on that?
You know, there is definitely some caution. It depends on who you talk to. But there is some caution in recognizing the cuts that we've already had, the unknown landscape that we're entering into.
And lawmakers say they don't want Missouri to become like Kansas.
Right.
You hear a lot of that. Yeah.
Right. And so I think that there is some disagreement, though, because, you know, we've certainly seen a handful of legislators that have proposed some pretty drastic tax measures that would certainly make Kansas look like a cakewalk.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, well, there is a lot of time left in session. They're just getting started on these things. But as they approach the budget, I think there may be a little more sober perspective on what they have to deal with.
You know, Tracy, the governor is proposing dropping the top individual income tax rate from 5.9% to 5.3%. But the corporate tax rate would drop more, at least in terms of percentage wise, from 6.25% to 4.25%. What's the thinking behind a greater cut, at least by percentage, for corporations? And what do you make of it?
Well, it seems to be another attempt at kind of this trickle-down theory. And I didn't get to catch all of it, but I heard a little bit of the Harley-Davidson story this morning. And they're building riders. You know, part of this is when we are able to target things like the earned income tax credit, and we get money in the hands of lower and middle income Missourians who go out and spend that money, that's when we see the demand increase. That is what businesses need to thrive, is they need that consumer demand. And, you know, Governor Greitens, a lot of these are more of kind of a top-down approach, when I think what we've seen over and over again, that it really needs to be putting money in the hands of people who are going to go out and spend it in their communities.
Again, we're talking about the Missouri tax cut proposal from Governor Eric Greitens and also the Missouri budget that just was proposed the other day. Let's go to the budget for a moment, Tracy. Your organization, again, released a statement talking about this just before the governor released his budget. And the budget project said this: without significant structural changes, our state will continue to scramble to provide basic services that allow Missouri's families and communities to thrive. You've been talking talking about that a little bit here this morning. But when you talk about significant structural changes, you're talking about what?
Again, a lot of what we've been talking about earlier. I mean, the governor in his proposal is right. We haven't updated our tax brackets. We believe there are other ways to do that that still allow us to fulfill the needs of our state.
And what that means is, like, most taxpayers, like a huge percentage of taxpayers, pay all the same rate, right?
Right. I mean, it's marginal, so they pay different rates on different amounts. They are paying less on their first dollars they make. But the highest bracket does go into effect at a very low wage. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be updated. It's from decades ago. It doesn't take into account changes since that time.
But the governor is not addressing that, though, is he?
He is in a different way.
Okay.
Again, we can, and we're actually going to be coming out with a publication on this soon, so we'll have more details to release. But we can target taxpayer relief to those that need it the most, mm-hmm. while still bringing in enough money to fund education and other services that families rely on to be able to have their families do better. You know, we grew up in these generations where parents hoped their kids would do better, and that's slowing down.
Meaning you're talking about taxing the rich more?
Not more, but that we can arrange our rate and stop some of these giveaways. That would allow us to both invest and not raise taxes on the majority of Missourians. But after decades of giveaways to folks, we are now scrambling to meet the basic needs of our communities.
Does Governor Greitens' budget differ much from the general approach that Governor Nixon took?
They are dealing with decades of cuts, and so their hands are tied in terms of what they can actually spend money on. And mm-hmm. so without addressing some of the problems on the other side of the ledger, it's hard to do too much. There aren't any major differences, though, in how things are invested in. There's a few small winners and losers, if you will.
Well, one of the losers is the higher education budget. The governor's talking about a trim of nearly $70 million. I should point out that UMKC holds a license to this station, and I teach up there, but $70 million is a lot of money.
Yeah, and it comes on the heels of cuts last year. When you compare the per pupil spending to 2008, we were spending at the state level about $7,600 per student. And now we're spending just a little over $5,000. Hmm. And so, this is a trajectory in the wrong direction for higher ed. And when we look at the decisions businesses make, we look at Amazon on both sides of the state. And I know a lot of the communities were saying, hey, this is a higher ed issue. We need to show that we're preparing our workforce.
Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. Lots of interesting issues packed into this budget and the spending plan the governor's now proposing. Tracy Gleason's with the Missouri Budget Project. Thanks for coming in today and enlightening us on all this. I sure appreciate it.
Good talking to you, Steve.
It's time for State House Blend Missouri, KCUR's weekly political podcast. This week, host Brian Ellison sat down with a brand new legislator about jumping into the middle of a turbulent political scene in Jeff City.
From KCUR Studios, this is State House Blend Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. It's a weekly podcast where we meet the people and the policies of Missouri government. Find out why they matter for our lives. This week, we're sitting down with the newest member of the Missouri House, Representative Barbara Ann Washington. She's a Democrat from Kansas City. Who is she? What's it like to jump right into the middle of the session? Representative Washington, welcome for the first time to State House Blend Missouri.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So what's it been like jumping in midstream? There's always a lot to learn, but usually you have other freshmen in the class to go through it with. You're all by yourself.
There's one other representative. There's a Republican, Representative Morse, who is from the southeastern part of the state, I believe. So we did start together.
Did they have a little orientation for the two of you?
We did actually have one this past Monday. I went down in December, and they definitely shook off some of the nervousness by walking me through the process and helping me to learn how to write a bill and who it goes to and what a greenback is and all of those sorts of things.
Wait, what is a greenback?
So when you're before you can file the bill, after you've edited everything and you have it right where you want it, it has to have a greenback, and then you sign the greenback, and then you can file it, and then it goes through the process where it'll have to be read a couple of times, then referred to a committee and that sort of thing.
You know, you don't think about these things when you're talking about the policies and the politics of all of it. There's a lot of logistics. Just filling out the right form is necessary for law to happen.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of making sure you actually know the process is...
You're talking about how to file a bill. Have you actually sponsored a couple bills already?
I have a couple of what we call consent bills, which are bills that don't have any financial impact and no controversy. So I have those. And then I have a bill that I'll file on Monday, which is an issue that's really near and dear to my heart, which is to raise the age for juveniles to be charged as adults. My bill takes into consideration some other issues besides just raising the age back to 18, which it used to be. There's some other meat I've taken out of what we have now as a statute. Right now, we can actually apply for a 12-year-old to be tried as an adult, and personally, I just think that's too young. So that'll be filed Monday, and then I'll start that process with begging that it can move through the ranks.
So you're getting right into it.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Let's talk about how you ended up here. In the middle of a term, a few months ago, you were just an attorney, happily practicing your,
yes,
your trade. How did this come to be? What led to you being asked to step into this role?
I knew I wanted to run for office for a long time, and I am friends with Randy Dunn and was speaking with Randy.
Who resigned and took a job in
so
Omaha.
I have taken over District 23, which was Randy Dunn's position. He had been here for 5 years. And we talked about it and how to get me prepared and ready to run in 2020, which is when he would have termed out. He got an amazing opportunity to continue to do great work. He is a planner by trade and to do economic development work at a nonprofit in Omaha, Nebraska. And he shared that with me earlier in 2017 and asked if I was still going to be was I ready to go now. And we just kind of started the process to get me ready and then to wait for the governor's announcement that he would have a special election. And I think the governor announced it, which is a special day for me, on July 31st, which would have been my mom's birthday. So that was pretty cool.
You mentioned that before this, you were an attorney. You're still an attorney. What kind of law do you practice?
I primarily practice personal injury and civil litigation, and a little criminal litigation. And I practice a lot of municipal court work. So thank God for the statute that allows me to get a continuance when I can't get back up here to go to court, because it is more intense than I thought it was going to be. I didn't know I had to be there on Mondays. I thought Monday would be a day. So I scheduled lots of court dates on Monday that I'm now having to change, to the chagrin of the judges who agreed to let me schedule things.
It's hard to have a professional quality legislature when people are only paid $36,000 a year and still really have to do their other jobs.
It is. So because it is a full-time job, I know the governor does not necessarily think so, but we are there every day. And we are at home in our communities working as well. When I leave here, I have a community meeting to attend. So as much as possible, I still want to meet with my constituents. We had a meeting before I left in December. So $36,000 is not a great living expense. You'll hear people say you get a per diem, and that's fine, but we spend that per diem to get there and get back and to eat and to pay rent. So $36,000 is not enough to live off of. You do need legislators to be able to earn a living so they can walk away from whatever else they were doing and put 1,000% of their concentration, efforts, and skills on making Missouri a better place.
One of the big news items of the week, Governor Greitens rolled out his budget proposal. It did include a proposed massive spending cut on higher education, similar to last year. You are a trustee of the Metropolitan Community College. One of the groups that will be significantly affected, one presumes, is the community college world. How will it affect students here in the Kansas City area?
Well, last year, the cut approved by both the House and the Senate, I think, was about 6.9% or something like that. And the governor went up more than that. So MCC alone, and MCC being Metropolitan Community Colleges, which is a five-campus system here on the Kansas City side, the Missouri side, we were hit personally by, I think, about $10 million. We were blessed that we had this spare $10 million out there that we got from, we'd had a long time, and one of our community partners had given us that as a grant. So we were okay last year. This year, I don't know. So we, as a community college system, and that is citywide, I mean statewide, and I know I'm active in the organization, we have to go to our community partners, and, you know, we're going to have to ask our partners to help us so that we don't affect the students as much with a tuition raise. We did raise a little bit last year, and we're probably going to raise just a little bit this year, but we have to make up the funding if we're going to continue to offer the quality education that we feel community colleges offer in the state of Missouri.
There was something else that happened the day you were sworn in. It was January 10th. It was the day of the State of the State address. I was there. It was a speech. And then something else happened.
Yeah, so my family came down. My daughter came back home from Brooklyn, New York, and was not a political person at all, and decided to stay for the State of the State. She wasn't sure, but she thought, there's some meat missing out of this speech, Mommy, don't you think? And I'm like, well, it's my first time too, but I agree. There wasn't much that the governor said. And we were not out of the building. Well, I'll be honest, most people had already heard the rumors, but January 10th does, I remember that more than the fact that I got sworn in for 5 minutes, that the issues with the governor with respect to the affair and the alleged blackmail and the alleged possible abuse.
You heard the governor say that he has moved on. He's answered the questions he intends to answer. Are you satisfied with that?
Absolutely not. You haven't answered the questions. Just because you say no is just not enough. And I'm more disappointed by the fact that the governor is in hiding. This is my first time being down there. I don't know how much the governor walks around. I don't know how much you see him. We had the State of Judiciary on Wednesday. I'm not sure if he's supposed to be there. If I was in hot water and news all over the world, my brother works for Al Jazeera in Doha, Qatar, and they've reported it, I probably would be a little more amenable to the media and amenable to my legislatures.
Think he should resign?
I think we should talk to him about it. I think we need to hear more. I don't think that he can put full concentration on the state of Missouri right now, which is what we need. And if we can't see that coming shortly, then he may need to investigate resigning.
We have one more question for you. It's a tradition on State House Blend.
Okay.
We ask you to pick one song that you think is really capturing this moment in the life of Missouri and maybe your first month in office.
Oh, no. There is a song called On Fire, and that is what we need to be doing. I think it's by Alicia Keys. And we need to probably, as Democrats, get to the point where we're on fire and we are doing what we need to do to light up the House, light up the Republicans, to bring our issues forth so that we can actually get something done that helps the working people of Missouri.
On fire it is. Representative Washington, thank you.
Thank you.
State House Blend Missouri is a production of KCUR Studios. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.
You can hear the entire episode of State House Blend Missouri, including Representative Barbara Ann Washington's thoughts on having to run for election again in just 7 months. Just go to kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow as we discuss President Trump's State of the Union address, and join KCUR tonight at Tap K downtown for a watch party and discussion panel. Check out the KCUR Facebook page for more details. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.